When Popovich and his friends displayed the fist around Belgrade, they included slogans like, "Resistance, because I love Serbia," "Fight the system," and "Resistance until victory." Prior to that, Serbians who privately opposed Milosevic's dictatorship feared expressing their disapproval in public. But when they saw the Otpor fist, they realized that others were willing to step forward. Later, when members of the movement were arrested, police officers asked them who was in charge. Popovich and his friends trained them to introduce themselves as one of 20,000 leaders of Otpor. Around the world, resistance movements have helped people overcome fear by turning on the go system with small actions that signal the support of a larger group. When Popovich trained the Egyptian activists, he shared a story from 1983 of how Chilean miners had mounted a protest against the country's dictator, Pinochet. Instead of taking the risk of going on strike, they issued a nationwide call for citizens to demonstrate their resistance by turning their lights on and off. People weren't afraid to do that, and soon they saw that their neighbors weren't either. The miners also invited people to start driving slowly. Taxi drivers slowed down. So did bus drivers. Soon, pedestrians were walking in slow motion down the streets and driving their cars and trucks at a glacial pace. In his inspiring book, Blueprint for Revolution, Popovich explains that prior to these activities, people were afraid to talk openly about despising Pinochet. So if you hated the dictator, you might have imagined that you were the only one. Tactics like these, Chileans used to say, made people realize that we are the many and they are the few. And the beauty was that there was no risk involved. Not even in North Korea was it illegal for cars to drive slowly. In Poland, when activists objected to government lies dominating the news, they knew that simply turning off their televisions wouldn't show their fellow citizens that they were ready to stand in protest. Instead, they put their TV sets in wheelbarrows and pushed them around the streets. Soon it was happening in towns throughout Poland, and the opposition eventually won power. In Syria, activists poured red food coloring in fountains around the squares of Damascus, symbolizing that citizens would not accept the bloody rule of their dictator, Assad. Instead of facing the terror of standing out as lone resistors, people were able to see themselves as members of a group. It's easier to rebel when it feels like an act of conformity. Other people are involved, so we can join too. In Serbia, Otpor found an ingenious way to activate the go system. The country was in such dire straits that excitement wasn't an easy emotion to cultivate. Popovich and his friends were able to transform fear into another strong positive emotion, hilarity. Flouting the solemn, resolute demeanor of great moral leaders like Gandhi, Otpor used humor to attract allies and subvert enemies. They sent birthday presents to Milosevic, a one-way ticket to The Hague to be tried for his war crimes, handcuffs, and a prison uniform. To celebrate the lunar eclipse, they invited downtown shoppers to gaze into a telescope which showed an eclipse of Milosevic's face. Later, Otpor produced a commercial with Milosevic's image on a T-shirt. "I've been trying to clean this stain for 10 years, a woman said, standing next to a washing machine. "Believe me, I've tried everything. But now there is a new machine. It has a great program which permanently cleans this and similar stains." In another case, as a crowd gathered, an Otpor activist grabbed a microphone and announced, "We are here reporting from in front of the Nish police station, and here is an example of a terrorist on the border between Serbia and Montenegro. The terrorist is about 6 feet tall, and he's wearing a T-shirt of the terrorist organization Otpor. He is wearing eyeglasses, which means he reads a lot. It's dangerous to read a lot in this country, so beware." In his workshops, Popovich trains revolutionaries to use humor as a weapon against fear. Not long after he spent some time with the Egyptian activists, an image began to spread around Egypt, a parody of a Microsoft Windows program installation. Installing Freedom. Copying files from Tunisia. Few days remaining. It was accompanied by an error message. Error installing Freedom. Cannot install Freedom. Please remove Mubarak and try again. As the image gained popularity, fear slowly faded. It's hard to be afraid of speaking up when you're laughing at the target of your rebellion. Effective displays of humor are what Popovich calls dilemma actions, choices that put oppressors in a lose-lose situation. In Syria, activists emblazon slogans like freedom and enough on thousands of ping-pong balls and dump them onto the streets of Damascus. When they heard the sound of the bouncing balls, Popovich observes, the people of Syria knew the nonviolent opposition was sticking its finger into the eye of Assad's regime. Soon enough, the police showed up. Huffing and puffing, these guys scoured the capital, scooping up ping-pong balls one by one. What the police didn't seem to realize, Popovich explains, was that in this slapstick comedy, the ping-pong balls were just the props. It was they themselves, the regime's enforcers, who had been cast to star as the clowns. It's easy to see how this kind of humor thrives against dictators who don't take kindly to jokes. But it can work in ordinary environments, too. Stanford professor Robert Sutton describes a group of young surgeons who regularly endured verbal abuse from attending surgeons. They were treated so poorly that they began to elect an attending asshole of the week, who became known as the AAOTW. Every Friday at a happy hour, they would nominate candidates and vote for a winner. They so despised one particular surgeon that they set a rule. In the event of a tie, he would win, even if he wasn't a finalist that week. They recorded the names of the biggest offenders in a leather-bound journal and wrote a summary of the behaviors that qualified the contestants for the top spot among the losers. The humor made surgeons' behavior less demoralizing and eventually dampened the young doctor's fear. They worked up the courage to pass the journal along to the entering chief resident each year. 20 years later, the journal is still in use by residents at the hospital. The surgeons who created it have themselves climbed to positions of power at hospitals around the country, vowing not to perpetrate or tolerate the kind of treatment to which they had been subjected. Popovich sees a role for amusement wherever fear runs rampant. Instead of trying to decelerate the stop system, he uses laughter to rev up the go system. When you have no power, it's a powerful way to convert strong negative emotions into positive ones. In one of his workshops, students were up in arms over the exorbitant price of tuition at their university. After hearing Popovich's stories, they proposed to approach the university president, show him pictures of their ramen-only diet, and invite themselves to weekly dinners at his house. Popovich smiled and nodded in approval. Whether they went ahead with the campaign or not, he had taught them how to fight fear with humor. If the president didn't welcome them for dinner, Popovich suggested, they ought to at least ask for his leftovers. But then he had a more somber message to deliver. The struggle for freedom is not all roses and unicorns. On the surface, Sergei Popovich is the picture of an optimist. When others were living in apathy, he envisioned a better future for Serbia. When others were crippled by fear, he brought laughter and was hopeful enough to believe that a group of students could defeat a formidable dictator. But when I asked whether his confidence was ever shaken, he immediately said yes. Did I feel self-doubt? Always, for 10 years. Even today, having led a successful revolution and trained so many activists to unseat dictators, he thinks about the lives lost in those movements and feels responsible for not having taught them enough. When we're dealing with anxiety, excitement and amusement aren't the only positive emotions that can activate the go system. When Elvis Presley had his personnel file created by the U.S. military, government clerks completed the forms using manual typewriters. By the 1980s, the IBM Selectric had replaced the antiquated manual typewriters, but little else had changed. When it came time to automate the process with desktop computers, the government employees responsible for completing these forms were already anxious that computers would eventually replace their jobs. Instead of trying to calm them down or reassure them, leaders activated the go system by evoking curiosity. They plunked the computers down on their desks right next to their trusted typewriters and simply announced that a test program would take place later. They didn't even plug them in. After about a week, they installed a few simple games and encouraged the clerks to try them out in their free time. The clerks were so intrigued that a few months later, when they started their official training, they had already taught themselves some of the key operations. As Brian Goshen, one of the leaders involved at the time, recalls, "By the time we were ready to start, they weren't afraid of it anymore. They were comfortable with the newer technology." It's one thing to motivate people to push a TV in the streets. Giving them the courage to take more meaningful action is a much greater challenge. When I asked Popovich how originals can activate the go system to mobilize a more substantial effort, he replied that we usually do it wrong. The Burning Platform. On New Year's Eve in 2000, Popovich and his friends organized a celebration in Republic Square. They lined up the hottest Serbian rock bands and spread the word that midnight would feature a live concert by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, an international sensation and a huge hit in Serbia. Thousands of people packed the square in Belgrade, dancing to the local bands and buzzing with anticipation about the main event. 1 minute before midnight, the square went dark, and people began counting down. But when the clock struck 12, no famous rock band appeared. The only audible sound was depressing music. As the audience listened in shock, a psychologist named Boris Tadic delivered a clear message from behind the stage. "We have nothing to celebrate," he said, asking them to go home and think about what action they would take. "This year has been a year of war and oppression, but it doesn't have to be that way. Let's make the coming year count, because 2000 is the year." Research by management professors Lynn Anderson and Thomas Bateman sheds light on the impact of that gesture. In a study of hundreds of managers and employees who championed environmental issues at their companies, the successful campaigns didn't differ from the failures in the amount of emotion they expressed, their use of metaphors or logical arguments, their efforts to consult key stakeholders, or their framing of a green movement as an opportunity or threat. The distinguishing factor was a sense of urgency. To convince leaders to sponsor the issue, create a task force, and spend time and money on it, the environmental champions had to articulate why the original cause needed to be adopted now. When Harvard professor John Cotter studied more than 100 companies trying to institute major changes, he found that the first error they made was failing to establish a sense of urgency. Over 50% of leaders fell short of convincing their employees that change needed to happen, and it needed to happen now. "Executives underestimate how hard it can be to drive people out of their comfort zones," Cotter writes. "Without a sense of urgency, people won't make needed sacrifices. Instead, they cling to the status quo and resist." Otpor conveyed urgency with slogans like "It's time" and "He's finished." When they announced, "This is the year," it was clear to the Serbians that there was a pressing need to act immediately. To further illuminate the effectiveness of an act like sending everyone home on New Year's Eve, let's look at a piece of research that transformed one field, spawned another, and ultimately won a Nobel Prize. Imagine that you're an executive at a car manufacturer, and due to economic challenges, you need to close 3 plants and lay off 6,000 employees. You can choose between 2 different plans. Plan A will save 1 of the 3 plants and 2,000 jobs. Plan B has a 1/3 chance of saving all 3 plants and all 6,000 jobs, but a 2/3 chance of saving no plants and no jobs. Most people prefer Plan A. In the original study, 80% chose to play it safe rather than take a chance. But suppose we gave you a different set of options. Plan A will lose 2 of the 3 plants and 4,000 jobs. Plan B has a 2/3 chance of losing all 3 plants and all 6,000 jobs, but a 1/3 chance of losing no plants and no jobs. Logically, these are the same options as the first set of choices, but psychologically, they don't feel the same. In the latter option, 82% of people prefer Plan B. Their preferences reverse. In the first case, the options are framed as gains. We prefer Plan A because we tend to be risk-averse in the domain of benefits. When we have a certain gain, we like to hold on to it and protect it. We play it safe to guarantee saving 2,000 jobs instead of taking a risk that might leave us saving no jobs. After all, a bird in the hand is worth 2 in the bush. But in the second case, we're presented with a guaranteed loss. Now we're willing to do whatever it takes to avoid that loss, even if it means risking an even bigger one. We're going to lose thousands of jobs anyway, so we throw caution to the wind and make the big gamble, hoping that we'll lose nothing. This line of research was conducted by psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman. It helped give rise to the field of behavioral economics and win Kahneman a Nobel Prize. It revealed that we can dramatically shift risk preferences just by changing a few words to emphasize losses rather than gains. This knowledge has major implications for understanding how to motivate people to take risks. If you want people to modify their behavior, is it better to highlight the benefits of changing or the costs of not changing? According to Peter Salovey, one of the originators of the concept of emotional intelligence and now the president of Yale, it depends on whether they perceive the new behavior as safe or risky. If they think the behavior is safe, we should emphasize all the good things that will happen if they do it. They'll want to act immediately to obtain those certain gains. But when people believe a behavior is risky, that approach doesn't work. They're already comfortable with the status quo, so the benefits of change aren't attractive, and the stop system kicks in. Instead, we need to destabilize the status quo and accentuate the bad things that will happen if they don't change. Taking a risk is more appealing when they're faced with a guaranteed loss if they don't. The prospect of a certain loss brings the go system online. At the pharmaceutical giant Merck, CEO Kenneth Frazier decided to motivate his executives to take a more active role in leading innovation and change. He asked them to do something radical, generate ideas that would put Merck out of business. For the next 2 hours, the executives worked in groups, pretending to be one of Merck's top competitors. Energy soared as they developed ideas for drugs that would crush theirs and key markets they had missed. Then, their challenge was to reverse their roles and figure out how to defend against these threats. The exercise capitalizes on a psychological difference between playing defense and playing offense. In studying counterterrorism teams in the intelligence community, Carnegie Mellon professor Anita Woolley finds that when teams are on defense, they tend to play it safe, attempting to protect against all competitive threats. They search for a lot of information, but can end up overwhelmed, with confidence waning. When teams are on offense, they consider many creative possibilities, but then drill down into one or two plans of attack. This kill the company exercise is powerful because it reframes a gain-framed activity in terms of losses. When deliberating about innovation opportunities, the leaders weren't inclined to take risks. When they considered how their competitors could put them out of business, they realized that it was a risk not to innovate. The urgency of innovation was apparent. To counter apathy, most change agents focus on presenting an inspiring vision of the future. This is an important message to convey, but it's not the type of communication that should come first. If you want people to take risks, you need first to show what's wrong with the present. To drive people out of their comfort zones, you have to cultivate dissatisfaction, frustration, or anger at the current state of affairs, making it a guaranteed loss. The greatest communicators of all time, says communication expert Nancy Duarte, who has spent her career studying the shape of superb presentations, start by establishing what is, here's the status quo. Then they compare that to what could be, making that gap as big as possible. We can see this sequence in two of the most revered speeches in American history. In his famous inaugural address, President Franklin D. Roosevelt opened by acknowledging the current state of affairs. Promising to speak the whole truth, frankly and boldly, he described the dire straits of the Great Depression, only then turning to what could be, unveiling his hope of creating new jobs and forecasting, "This great nation will revive and will prosper. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." When we recall Martin Luther King Jr.'s epic speech, what stands out is a shining image of a brighter future. Yet in his 16-minute oration, it wasn't until the 11th minute that he first mentioned his dream. Before delivering hope for change, King stressed the unacceptable conditions of the status quo. In his introduction, he pronounced that, despite the promise of the Emancipation Proclamation, 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. Having established urgency through depicting the suffering that was, King turned to what could be. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. He devoted more than two-thirds of the speech to these 1-2 punches, alternating between what was and what could be, by expressing indignation at the present and hope about the future. According to sociologist Patricia Wasilewski, King articulates the crowd's feelings of anger at existing inequities, strengthening their resolve that the situation must be changed. The audience was only prepared to be moved by his dream of tomorrow after he had exposed the nightmare of today. Psychologists Min-Jung Koo and Ayelet Fishbach find that when we're experiencing doubts on the way toward achieving a goal, whether we ought to look backward or forward depends on our commitment. When our commitment is wavering, the best way to stay on track is to consider the progress we've already made. As we recognize what we've invested and attained, it seems like a waste to give up, and our confidence and commitment surge. In the early days of Otpor, Serja Popovich and his friends dealt with doubt and fear by helping people laugh and accumulate small wins. That way, they could look back and gain a sense of progress, which turned anxiety into enthusiasm and secured their dedication. Once commitment is fortified, instead of glancing in the rearview mirror, it's better to look forward by highlighting the work left to be done. When we're determined to reach an objective, it's the gap between where we are and where we aspire to be that lights a fire under us. In Serbia, as the Otpor movement drew a loyal following that was no longer frozen in fear, it was time to show them how much distance they had yet to travel. That's why Popovich and his friends halted the concert and sent the citizens of Belgrade home on New Year's Eve. In the span of less than 2 years, Otpor had accumulated more than 70,000 members in 130 different branches. But to actually overthrow Milosevic, they would need millions of votes. A few years earlier, Milosevic had agreed to a relatively democratic election, and won. His minions controlled the ballot boxes. Even if Serbians could vote him out of office, would he concede? Popovic and his allies understood that they needed intense emotions to propel action across the country. It was time to destabilize the status quo and turn on the go system by reminding them that there was nothing to celebrate because the present was intolerable. Instead of courage, management guru Tom Peters recommends fostering a level of fury with the status quo such that one cannot not act. The show must go on. Anger counteracts apathy. We feel that we've been wronged and we're compelled to fight. But it can also go too far. Anger doesn't just activate the go system. It drops a heavy brick on the gas pedal. It's a force that motivates people to speak up and act, but it can also make them less effective in doing so. After studying activists, Deborah Meyerson and Maureen Scully suggest that the key is to be simultaneously hot and cool-headed. The heat fuels action and change. The coolness shapes the action and change into legitimate and viable forms. But once the heat is on, how do we keep our cool? According to Berkeley sociologist Arlie Hochschild, if you're feeling an intense emotion like anxiety or anger, there are two ways to manage it. Surface acting and deep acting. Surface acting involves putting on a mask, modifying your speech, gestures, and expressions to present yourself as unfazed. If you're a flight attendant and an angry passenger begins yelling at you, you might smile to feign warmth. You're adjusting your outward appearance, but your internal state is unchanged. You're furious with the passenger, and the passenger probably knows it. Russian theater director Konstantin Stanislavski observed that in surface acting, actors were never fully immersed in the role. They were always aware of the audience, and their performances never came across as authentic. Stanislavski wrote that surface acting will neither warm your soul nor penetrate deeply into it. Delicate and deep human feelings are not subject to such technique. In deep acting, known as method acting in the theater world, you actually become the character you wish to portray. Deep acting involves changing your inner feelings, not just your outer expressions of them. If you're the flight attendant in the above example, you might imagine that the passenger is stressed, afraid of flying, or going through a messy divorce. You feel empathy for the passenger, and the smile comes naturally to you, creating a more genuine expression of warmth. Deep acting dissolves the distinction between your true self and the role you are playing. You are no longer acting because you are actually experiencing the genuine feelings of the character. Before Lewis Pugh embarks on a freezing swim, he engages in deep acting. While listening to songs by Eminem and P. Diddy, he calls up vivid memories of leaping out of an airplane from his days in the British Special Forces. He is reliving the intense excitement he wants to experience again. The Oscar-winning actor Daniel Day-Lewis goes a step further. To prepare himself for a role in Arthur Miller's The Crucible, he built a house using 17th-century tools and lived with no running water or electricity. When he played a writer with cerebral palsy in My Left Foot, he spent the entire production process in a wheelchair, speaking in broken dialect and allowing crew members to feed him with a spoon. As an actor, He's ultimately still playing a character. But the purpose of deep acting is to feel the emotions he wants to display. Deep acting turns out to be a more sustainable strategy for managing emotions than surface acting. Research shows that surface acting burns us out. Faking emotions that we don't really feel is both stressful and exhausting. If we want to express a set of emotions, we need to actually experience them. When Sergei Popovich and his colleagues train activists, they teach deep acting through role-playing exercises. In the Maldives, for example, they had people play the parts of business leaders, hotel owners, island elders, expatriates in India, and police and security guards. This gave them the chance to anticipate how others would react and practice their own responses. Fanning the Flame. Less than a year after Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to sit in the back of a Montgomery bus, the Supreme Court outlawed segregation. To prepare citizens for the racial conflicts that might ensue on integrated buses, Martin Luther King Jr. designed and delivered workshops for thousands of black Alabamans, working in concert with nonviolence experts like James Lawson, Bayard Rustin, and Glenn Smiley. The team simulated a bus by setting up rows of chairs and assigned about a dozen different audience members to play the driver and passengers. The white passengers called the black ones names. They spat on them, smashed gum and flicked cigarette ashes in their hair, dumped milk on their heads, and squirted ketchup and mustard in their faces. In this deep acting exercise, King wanted to make black citizens angry enough to stand in protest, but not so angry that they would resort to violence. What would be the best way to handle their anger? The most popular strategy for doing so is venting. Therapists advise us to blow off steam by hitting a pillow or screaming. By expressing our pent-up rage, Freud argued, we can relieve the pressure and find catharsis. In the movie Analyze This, Billy Crystal plays a psychiatrist tasked with helping mobster Robert De Niro manage his anger. Crystal recommends hitting a pillow, and De Niro grabs a gun, aims at a couch, and starts shooting at a pillow. Crystal, shaken, asks, "Feel better?" "Yeah," De Niro replies, "I do." To test whether venting helps with managing anger, psychologist Brad Bushman designed a shrewd experiment to make people angry. The participants were asked to write an essay about whether they were against abortion or pro-choice. They then received some harsh written feedback from a peer with the opposite view, who rated their essays as disorganized, unoriginal, poorly written, unclear, unpersuasive, and low in quality, adding, "This is one of the worst essays I have read." The angry recipients were then randomly assigned to one of three responses: venting, distraction, or control. The members of the venting group were allowed to hit a punching bag as hard as they wanted for as long as they liked, while thinking about the jerk who criticized their essays and looking at his picture. The distraction group hit the punching bag, but was instructed to think about becoming physically fit, and was shown a photo of someone exercising. In the control group, there was no punching bag. Participants sat quietly for 2 minutes while the computer was being fixed. Which group would become the most aggressive toward the peer who insulted them? To find out, Bushman gave each of the groups the chance to blast their essay's critic with noise, letting them determine the volume and duration of the sonic blasts. The venting group was the most aggressive. They slammed the critic with more intense noise and held the button down longer than the distraction and control groups. One participant got so angry after thinking about the insulting feedback that hitting the punching bag wasn't enough. He punched a hole in the wall of the lab. Venting doesn't extinguish the flame of anger. It feeds it. When we vent our anger, we put a lead foot on the gas pedal of the GO system, attacking the target who enraged us. Hitting the punching bag without thinking of the target, though, keeps the GO system on, but enables us to consider alternative ways of responding. Sitting quietly begins to activate the stop system. Catharsis seems to work best once a certain period of time has passed. After the terrorist attacks of September 11, legions of more than 9,000 counselors descended upon New York, hoping to prevent post-traumatic stress and relieve symptoms of anxiety, depression, and grief. Psychologist Timothy Wilson describes how many of the counselors conducted critical incident stress debriefing, encouraging trauma victims and observers to spend several hours expressing their thoughts and feelings as soon as possible. Unfortunately, this didn't do much good for local citizens, firefighters, and other people close to the tragedy. In one study of people who suffered severe burns in a fire, those who went through critical incident stress debriefing had higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and anxiety more than a year later. Psychologist James Pennebaker has demonstrated that expressing our thoughts and feelings about a stressful or traumatic event is most salutary after we've had some time to process the event, when we're not blinded by anger or consumed by distress. In other studies, Bushman has demonstrated that venting doesn't work even if you think it does, and even if it makes you feel good. The better you feel after venting, the more aggressive you get, not only toward your critic, but also toward innocent bystanders. Avoiding venting was a central theme in the training of activists in the civil rights movement. Since nonviolent resistance depends on controlling anger, King and his colleagues made a concerted effort in their workshops to stop venting in its tracks. Sometimes the person playing a white man put so much zeal into his performance that he had to be gently reproved from the sidelines, King reflected. In response, a citizen playing a black man often forgot his nonviolent role and struck back with vigor. Whenever this happened, we worked to rechannel his words and deeds in a nonviolent direction. After every performance, the group provided feedback and suggestions for responding more constructively. One of the fundamental problems with venting is that it focuses attention on the perpetrator of injustice. The more you think about the person who wronged you, the more violently you want to lash out in retaliation. Anger is a powerful mobilizing tool, Sergey Popovich explains. But if you make people angry, they might start breaking things. On New Year's Eve at midnight in 2000, when Otpor shut down the concert, turned off the lights, and played sad music, only one sight was visible, a gigantic screen, on which a slideshow of pictures was being played, none of which featured the despised Milosevic. The images instead were of Serbian soldiers and police officers who had been killed under Milosevic's rule. To channel anger productively, instead of venting about the harm that a perpetrator has done, we need to reflect on the victims who have suffered from it. Management researchers Andrew Brodsky, Joshua Margolis, and Joel Brockner find that focusing on the victims of injustice spurs us to speak truth to power. In one experiment, adults witnessed a CEO overpaying himself and underpaying a star employee. When they were prompted to focus on the employee who was treated unfairly, they were 46% more likely to challenge the CEO's payment decision. In the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. frequently called attention to victims of violence and injustice. "We are not out to defeat or humiliate the white man," he pronounced in a 1956 speech defending the Montgomery bus boycott, "but to free our children from a life of permanent psychological death." Focusing on the victim activates what psychologists call empathetic anger, the desire to right wrongs done unto another. It turns on the GO system, but it makes us thoughtful about how to best respect the victim's dignity. Research demonstrates that when we're angry at others, we aim for retaliation or revenge. But when we're angry for others, we seek out justice and a better system. We don't just want to punish, we want to help. When Otpor displayed the images of dead soldiers, Serbians were pumped with empathetic adrenaline and broke out into a chant, "Let's make the coming year count!" They weren't going to get excited about actually taking down their dictator, but they could feel enough righteous indignation that they were determined to do so. In Popovich's words, there was an energy in the air that no rock band could ever recreate. Everybody felt that they had something important to do. That autumn, Otpor mobilized one of the largest voter turnouts in Serbia's history, defeating Milosevic and shepherding in a new era of democracy. Boris Tadic, the psychologist who had sent everyone home because there was nothing to celebrate, was elected president of Serbia 4 years later. I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world, E.B. White once wrote. This makes it difficult to plan the day. The Declaration of Independence promises Americans the unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the quest for happiness, many of us choose to enjoy the world as it is. Originals embrace the uphill battle, striving to make the world what it could be. By struggling to improve life and liberty, they may temporarily give up some pleasure, putting their own happiness on the back burner. In the long run, though, they have the chance to create a better world. And that, to borrow a turn of phrase from psychologist Brian Little, brings a different kind of satisfaction. Becoming original is not the easiest path in the pursuit of happiness, but it leaves us perfectly poised for the happiness of pursuit. Actions for Impact. If you're seeking to unleash originality, here are some practical actions that you can take. The first steps are for individuals to generate, recognize, voice, and champion new ideas. The next set is for leaders to stimulate novel ideas and build cultures that welcome dissent. The final recommendations are for parents and teachers to help children become comfortable taking a creative or moral stand against the status quo. To gauge your originality with a free assessment, visit www.adamgrant.net. Individual actions. A. Generating and recognizing original ideas. 1. Question the default. Instead of taking the status quo for granted, ask why it exists in the first place. When you remember that rules and systems were created by people, it becomes clear that they're not set in stone, and you begin to consider how they can be improved. 2. Triple the number of ideas you generate. Just as great baseball players only average a hit for every 3 at-bats, every innovator swings and misses. The best way to boost your originality is to produce more ideas. 3. Immerse yourself in a new domain. Originality increases when you broaden your frame of reference. One approach is to learn a new craft, like the Nobel Prize-winning scientists who expanded their creative repertoires by taking up painting, piano, dance, or poetry. Another strategy is to try a job rotation. Get trained to do a position that requires a new base of knowledge and skills. A third option is to learn about a different culture, like the fashion designers who became more innovative when they lived in foreign countries that were very different from their own. You don't need to go abroad to diversify your experience. You can immerse yourself in the culture and customs of a new environment simply by reading about it. 4. Procrastinate strategically. When you're generating new ideas, deliberately stop when your progress is incomplete. By taking a break in the middle of your brainstorming or writing process, you're more likely to engage in divergent thinking and give ideas time to incubate. 5. Seek more feedback from peers. It's hard to judge your own ideas because you tend to be too enthusiastic, and you can't trust your gut if you're not an expert in the domain. It's also tough to rely on managers, who are typically too critical when they evaluate ideas. To get the most accurate reviews, run your pitches by peers. They're poised to spot the potential and the possibilities. B. Voicing and championing original ideas. 6. Balance your risk portfolio. When you're going to take a risk in one domain, offset it by being unusually cautious in another realm of your life. Like the entrepreneurs who kept their day jobs while testing their ideas, or Carmen Medina taking a job to protect against security leaks when she was pushing the CIA to embrace the internet, this can help you avoid unnecessary gambles. 7. Highlight the reasons not to support your idea. Remember Rufus Griscom, the entrepreneur in Chapter 3, who told investors why they shouldn't invest in his company? You can do this too. Start by describing the three biggest weaknesses of your idea, and then ask them to list several more reasons not to support it. Assuming that the idea has some merit, when people have to work hard to generate their own objections, they will be more aware of its virtues. 8. Make your ideas more familiar. Repeat yourself. It makes people more comfortable with an unconventional idea. Reactions typically become more positive after 10 to 20 exposures to an idea, particularly if they're short, spaced apart by a few days, and mixed in with other ideas. You can also make your original concept more appealing by connecting it with other ideas that are already understood by the audience, like when the Lion King script was reframed as Hamlet with lions. 9. Speak to a different audience. Instead of seeking out friendly people who share your values, try approaching disagreeable people who share your methods. In the U.S. Navy, a young aviator named Ben Coleman created a highly effective rapid innovation cell by assembling a band of junior officers who had disciplinary actions brought against them for challenging authority. They had a history of principled dissent, and although they held different objectives, their habits of loyal opposition meshed well. Your best allies are the people who have a track record of being tough and solving problems with approaches similar to yours. 10. Be a tempered radical. If your idea is extreme, couch it in a more conventional goal. That way, instead of changing people's minds, you can appeal to values or beliefs that they already hold. You can use a Trojan horse, as Meredith Perry did when she masked her vision for wireless power behind a request to design a transducer. You can also position your proposal as a means to an end that matters to others, like Frances Willard reframing the right to vote as a way for conservative women to protect their homes from alcohol abuse. And if you're already known as too extreme, you can shift from leader to lightning rod, allowing more moderate people to take the reins. C. Managing emotions. 11. Motivate yourself differently when you're committed versus uncertain. When you're determined to act, focus on the progress left to go. You'll be energized to close the gap. When your conviction falters, think of the progress you've already made. Having come this far, how could you give up now? 12. Don't try to calm down. If you're nervous, it's hard to relax. It's easier to turn anxiety into intense positive emotions like interest and enthusiasm. Think about the reasons you're eager to challenge the status quo and the positive outcomes that might result. 13. Focus on the victim, not the perpetrator. In the face of injustice, thinking about the perpetrator fuels anger and aggression. Shifting your attention to the victim makes you more empathetic, increasing the chances that you'll channel your anger in a constructive direction. Instead of trying to punish the people who caused harm, you'll be more likely to help the people who were harmed. 14. Realize you're not alone. Even having a single ally is enough to dramatically increase your will to act. Find one person who believes in your vision and begin tackling the problem together. 15. Remember that if you don't take initiative, the status quo will persist. Consider the four responses to dissatisfaction: exit, voice, persistence, and neglect. Only exit and voice improve your circumstances. Speaking up may be the best route if you have some control over the situation. If not, it may be time to explore options for expanding your influence or leaving. Leader actions. A. Sparking original ideas. 1. Run an innovation tournament. Welcoming suggestions on any topic at any time doesn't capture the attention of busy people. Innovation tournaments are highly efficient for collecting a large number of novel ideas and identifying the best ones. Instead of a suggestion box, send a focused call for ideas to solve a particular problem or meet an untapped need. Give employees 3 weeks to develop proposals and then have them evaluate one another's ideas, advancing the most original submissions to the next round. The winners receive a budget, a team, and the relevant mentoring and sponsorship to make their ideas a reality. 2. Picture yourself as the enemy. People often fail to generate new ideas due to a lack of urgency. You can create urgency by implementing the kill the company exercise from Lisa Bodell, CEO of FutureThink. Gather a group together and invite them to spend an hour brainstorming about how to put the organization out of business or decimate its most popular product, service, or technology. Then hold a discussion about the most serious threats and how to convert them into opportunities to transition from defense to offense. 3. Invite employees from different functions and levels to pitch ideas. At DreamWorks Animation, even accountants and lawyers are encouraged and trained to present movie ideas. This kind of creative engagement can add skill variety to work, making it more interesting for employees while increasing the organization's access to new ideas. And involving employees in pitching has another benefit. When they participate in generating ideas, they adopt a creative mindset that leaves them less prone to false negatives, making them better judges of their colleagues' ideas. 4. Hold an opposite day. Since it's often hard to find the time for people to consider original viewpoints, one of my favorite practices is to have opposite day in the classroom and at conferences. Executives and students divide into groups, and each chooses an assumption, belief, or area of knowledge that is widely taken for granted. Each group asks, "When is the opposite true?" and then delivers a presentation on their ideas. 5. Ban the words like, love, and hate. At the nonprofit DoSomething.org, CEO Nancy Lublin forbade employees from using the words like, love, and hate because they make it too easy to give a visceral response without analyzing it. Employees aren't allowed to say they prefer one web page over another. They have to explain their reasoning with statements like, "This page is stronger because the title is more readable than the other options." This motivates people to contribute new ideas rather than just rejecting existing ones. B. Building cultures of originality. 6. Hire not on cultural fit, but on cultural contribution. When leaders prize cultural fit, they end up hiring people who think in similar ways. Originality comes not from people who match the culture, but from those who enrich it. Before interviews, identify the diverse backgrounds, skill sets, and personality traits that are currently missing from your culture. Then place a premium on those attributes in the hiring process. 7. Shift from exit interviews to entry interviews. Instead of waiting to ask for ideas until employees are on their way out the door, start seeking their insights when they first arrive. By sitting down with new hires during onboarding, you can help them feel valued and gather novel suggestions along the way. Ask what brought them in the door and what would keep them at the firm, and challenge them to think like culture detectives. They can use their insider-outsider perspectives to investigate which practices belong in a museum and which should be kept, as well as potential inconsistencies between espoused and enacted values. 8. Ask for problems, not solutions. If people rush to answers, you end up with more advocacy than inquiry, and miss out on the breadth of knowledge in the room. Following Bridgewater's issue log, you can create an open document for teams to flag problems that they see. On a monthly basis, bring people together to review them and figure out which ones are worth solving. 9. Stop assigning devil's advocates and start unearthing them. Dissenting opinions are useful even when they're wrong, but they're only effective if they're authentic and consistent. Instead of assigning people to play the devil's advocate, find people who genuinely hold minority opinions and invite them to present their views. To identify these people, try appointing an information manager. Make someone responsible for seeking out team members individually before meetings to find out what they know. 10. Welcome criticism. It's hard to encourage dissent if you don't practice what you preach. When Ray Dalio received an email criticizing his performance in an important meeting, copying it to the entire company sent a clear message that he welcomed negative feedback. By inviting employees to criticize you publicly, you can set the tone for people to communicate more openly, even when their ideas are unpopular. Parent and teacher actions. 1. Ask children what their role models would do. Children feel free to take initiative when they look at problems through the eyes of originals. Ask children what they would like to improve in their family or school. Then have them identify a real person or fictional character they admire for being unusually creative and inventive. What would that person do in this situation? 2. Link good behaviors to moral character. Many parents and teachers praise helpful actions, but children are more generous when they're commended for being helpful people. It becomes part of their identity. If you see a child do something good, try saying, "You're a good person because you blank." Children are also more ethical when they're asked to be moral people. They want to earn the identity. If you want a child to share a toy, instead of asking, "Will you share?" ask, "Will you be a sharer?" 3. Explain how bad behaviors have consequences for others. When children misbehave, help them see how their actions hurt other people. How do you think this made her feel? As they consider the negative impact on others, children begin to feel empathy and guilt, which strengthens their motivation to right the wrong and to avoid the action in the future. 4. Emphasize values over rules. Rules set limits that teach children to adopt a fixed view of the world. Values encourage children to internalize principles for themselves. When you talk about standards, like the parents of the Holocaust rescuers, describe why certain ideals matter to you and ask children why they're important.